Ed, welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all your questions about astronomy and related issues. One of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, Bob can translate complex scientific concepts into terms that even I can understand. It's always fun to have Bob on the program. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or if you wish, you can check in with us on Twitter at WAMC Vox Pop on Twitter, or on Facebook at facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Mr. Berman, nice to have you back.
A pleasure, Ray. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
So, big meteor shower. We might actually be able to see it. We have some clear skies out there right now.
Yeah, this is a rare one for us, as you well know. You mentioned that earlier, that here we've got not just the best meteor shower of the year. Mm. You know, often it's the Perseids every August 11th. Not this year. It's tonight's Geminid shower, but it's occurring under dark skies. It's a new moon. Yeah. Plus, the forecast is for only partly cloudy. So this should really be a great shower.
Now, what makes it, you just said this is going to be the best one of the year. How do you know that the volume of those things that burn up in our upper atmosphere are going to be more than usual?
Well, good question. And both showers have the potential to deliver a meteor a minute. The real difference is the moon. Is there going to be some moonlight, no moonlight? This one has no moonlight whatsoever. And last night, I went out for a while at 11 o'clock and actually saw about 8 meteors in 10 or 15 minutes, which is quite nice for the night before. So I would just advise everybody to get out, particularly after 10 o'clock. You'll see them almost from nightfall on, but there might only be one every 3, 4, 5 minutes then. After about 10 o'clock, I think you'll see a meteor a minute. You could look anywhere in the sky, but somewhat more if you look toward the northeast. And just keep watching. The meteor rules are really simple, and that is don't keep looking down and just glance up from time to time. You need to just keep watching the sky. If you have a hot tub, that would be perfect.
Well,
otherwise,
yes.
note
to self, buy hot tub. Okay, yes.
Otherwise, a lawn chair, if you can handle that, you know, in December being outdoors, but should be really, really great. I'm very excited about this one.
You know, as you walked in the building, you said we should talk about some of the great celestial events that you don't need a telescope to see. You just go out and take a look.
Yes, and this, of course, is a great example of it because a telescope will just look through a tiny, narrow tunnel with a small field. Here you want to see as much sky as possible. For those listeners who are away from the lights of a city, just make sure your house lights are turned off, and that's the only thing you really need, and to keep looking upward. And if you go out and if it's kind of mostly cloudy, then try it again in half an hour or an hour. You really need clear skies and you need an open patch of sky. You don't want to be just glancing between trees or between buildings. A nice open spot is really good. So meteor shower is number one.
Right.
Not number one meaning the greatest cosmic spectacle. That would be a total solar eclipse.
Right, which you have just returned from seeing.
Yes, just got back from Australia and New Zealand. And our group of 41 people, we were just so fortunate in that it was cloudy every morning and the eclipse was going to occur just after sunrise as seen from the beach. This is tropical northeastern Australia, just 16 degrees from the equator.
Yeah.
And it was just cloudy, 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 cloudy. We didn't have one perfectly clear day leading up to it.
Yeah.
So it seemed, we were almost despondent.
Were you nervous?
I was.
So I got to pay all these people back?
Not to pay them back. I just felt so bad because of the 41, only 6 had previously seen a total solar eclipse. And out of those, half of those had been clouded out previously.
Yeah.
So it was so important to me that they get to see it. They'd heard about how glorious it is. It's the greatest thing the eye can see. People weep, and they do.
Did you weep?
I didn't.
All right.
I was not in touch with that
man,
side of
Bob
me.
You're a hard man, Bob Berman.
But several of our people did. And I'm glad to say some of the people from our area here had signed on. We had three people from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, and a couple from New Paltz, and
nice.
Another couple from Kingston. And there's a woman, a physician from Cooperstown. So a number of people from our area. And unfortunately, as the hour-long partial eclipse progressed and the sun got tinier and tinier and the light got stranger and stranger, at the moment of totality, the sun went behind a cloud and I thought, oh, no. But it emerged just seconds later, and we all got to see it. And it just reaffirmed, this was my seventh, but I didn't need reaffirming, that it is just a knockout sight. And people would think, well, yeah, sure, because he's an astronomer and he thinks so. But I tell you, other types of eclipses, a lunar eclipse where the moon turns red, the full moon turns red,
yeah.
It's nice.
It is
interesting,
nice.
But it's not life-altering. And a partial solar eclipse, which we get here maybe every 6, 7, 8 years, and which you need eye protection for, they're also kind of interesting. But this is, as I said, it makes animals go crazy, it makes people weep. But there's something magical in the air. You can't even describe it visually, because the visual thing is not the experience. So that total eclipse, that's first
okay,
and
that's,
foremost.
That's number one.
And if anyone's appetite is whetted and they're thinking, okay, well, where can I see one? Unfortunately, they're rare. They only occur every 360 years in any given location.
Yeah.
For example, Albany last had one back in 1925.
Okay.
And we'll next have one in 2079.
Oh,
on May 1st.
2079?
Yes.
So it's only, 100 years then?
Yeah, we beat the odds.
Ah.
There are places like the state of Arizona that won't have one in a 500-year period. So it's just sort of random who gets them.
And how about a comet? In other words, my grandmother always talked about Halley's Comet when it came in the early 1900s.
In 1910.
Yeah.
That was a fantastic visit of it. Unfortunately, in our lifetime, Comet Halley was on the wrong side of the sun for us. We were on one side of the solar orbit. It was on the wrong side. So it was about the worst visit in the last 2,000 years. But it comes back once a lifetime, every 76 years.
Yep.
The next time, in 2061, it's supposed to be really, truly spectacular, with a tail crossing about half the sky. And the time after that, in 2137, we should have the best visit of Halley's Comet in a couple of centuries.
Hmm.
But a great comet, a comet as good as Comet Halley, does come around every 15 or 20 years on average. And we are expecting now, it's just discovered September 21st, we are expecting now a fabulous one called Comet Ison, that will be performing a year from now, next November.
Okay.
And will be visible right from here. You don't have to travel to any other place to see it. And it should have a tail that should streak across the sky as seen in the early morning. But we'll talk about it when we get closer to that. So we have a total solar eclipse.
Check.
A great comet.
Check.
Check off. A all-sky display of the Aurora Borealis.
Mm-hmm.
And because Solar Max is just a few months away now, we think we're going to get some great displays of those in the next 2 years, and we see them well from here. As you know, I lead a group to Central Alaska every March to see that.
Yeah.
I'm going to go again, but you don't have to go there. When the displays really get cranking, we see them right from here, from the rural areas.
Sure.
And then finally, fourth would be an exploding meteor or bolide. Most shooting stars that we see from a shower like tonight's are not of that type. They don't blow up. They don't cast shadows. But once in a while, you get one like that.
Yeah.
So those are the great events that you need no star charts, no astronomy knowledge, no telescope. You just look up and it'll just almost life-changing, some of those.
You know, Kohoutek was much ballyhooed back. Well, I don't know how long ago that was.
Yeah,
in the
70s. In 73, I think.
Right. And they said, oh, this is going to be great. And it wasn't great.
It was terrible. And that's why we put a little asterisk when we talk about Comet Ison, because it could be great. We always know where the comet's going to be, but as to how its ices will react to the sun, how brilliant and how large its tail will become, you never know until the comet actually gets there.
Now, does solar max play into that? In other words, the sun being more energetic, will that affect what we see in the tail of the comet?
Great question, and not very much.
The
sun will be more energetic. The solar wind may be stronger and faster, but the tail, it's always like an airport windsock. It's always going to point away from the sun. And if the solar wind's a little stronger, a little less strong, that won't affect it very much.
Okay, well, let's get at least one or two in before the first break at 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman is our guest. And we'll go to Paul in Schenectady. Paul, you're on.
Hey, I have a question about the rising and setting times of the sun and their relationship to the solstice.
Sure.
I had always assumed that since the solstice was the shortest day of the year, that that was also the day where the sun would rise the latest and set the earliest.
Right, but it's not so, yes.
No, and that kind of freaks me out. And I'm wondering what exactly is going on there and if it's related to the wobble of the axial tilt of the Earth, if it's related to the solar analemma, and if Earth's rotational speed changes at all.
Okay.
Yeah, of those three choices, you actually had the correct answer in one of those three choices. It's related to the analemma, would explain it. And the analemma, for people who don't know, is if you took a photograph of the sun, just a quick picture, let's say every morning at the same time, say 8 o'clock, throughout the year, eventually you would get a figure 8 shape or an infinity sign, because the sun, where the sun is relative to our clocks at the same time of day, changes both in its height and its location in the sky.
Yeah.
And so that's really telling you, how does the sun relate to our clocks? And because of that system, the time of earliest sunset, in other words, the darkest afternoon, is not the solstice, as our listener just correctly noted, but on December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day every year. So the darkest afternoon is already behind us now. It's already, the afternoons are already getting brighter.
Huh.
And the sun is already setting later. Conversely, the darkest mornings are yet to come. They don't happen until the first week of January, and that's when the earliest sunrise occurs. So you have your it's centered on the solstice. The winter solstice is the day with the shortest minutes of sunlight, but the time of sunset and the time of sunrise are each shifted about 2 weeks before and after that date.
Paul, great question. We're going to take a break here. Zach, let's hit the music, and then we'll come back. And, lots of good stuff to talk about with our guest today, including the end of the world. It's coming up.
Support comes from Ashokan Center, Olive Bridge, New York. New Year's Eve dinner and dance party featuring swing, Cajun, contras, and waltzes with the Revelers, Tunescape, Jay and Molly, and Swingology. Ashokan.org. New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners, working to reduce youth and adult smoking rates across the state and help save lives. New York State Tobacco-Free Community Partners at SmokeFreeCapital.org. NoHo Pizza, Albany, New York, offering pizza, salads, subs, and more, lunch deliveries, and catering available. 518-433-1111. And Harlow Luggage, Northampton, Massachusetts, featuring Briggs & Riley and Eagle Creek Luggage, handbags by Bagolini, leather goods, silver jewelry, and gifts and accessories by Brighton. Online at shopharlows.com.
One 800-348-2551, the telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. Our producer, Zach Malloy, is not our producer. He's our engineer. Our producer, Patrick Donjus, is here, and he's on Twitter.
Hello.
We're turning his microphone on, and he says use microphone 4.
Okay.
Here we go. This is Adventures in Radio.
Two mics.
There we are.
Hi. Julie on Facebook, that's facebook.com/WAMC Radio, says, basic question for Bob, who keeps track of all these celestial events and movement of stuff in the sky, and who pays them to do so? For example, where do astronomers go to earn a living? Who pays them to do what and why?
Well, he's not making any money here. We know that.
It's a disparate organization. There is no organization. There are universities that obviously are involved in research and in education. There are private institutions such as the Carnegie Institution, very prestigious, and which is based in California in Pasadena, but also has their main observatories down in Chile, in Las Campanas. Then there are government-funded places like Kitt Peak, the National Solar Telescope. So the funding comes from a lot of different sources, some of it from the government, some of it private.
How about alarmist books about the end of the world? Yeah? What do you think? You know, just a little inside baseball, and I promise we'll get right back to the phones. Merle is next. But when Bob walked in, we said, well, do we discuss the elephant in the room or do we not discuss the elephant in the room? And you said, this is so huge from the attention it's getting, people looking at the sun, and tell them what we're talking about.
Yes, because I think everybody now knows about the Mayan calendar, which is going to flip over its so-called long count on December 21st at the moment of the solstice.
Right.
And, you know, less than a year ago, I was down on the Yucatan doing some lecturing there, and I met several Mesoamerican scholars, including, this was a very fortuitous meeting, the son of a person I knew way back in the 70s who was down there. And he was of Mayan descent.
Yeah.
And the people who are the actual Mayan descent and the people who are knowledgeable and the scholars in this, they're all flipped over this. They love this stuff because they're expecting to get lots of tour groups, lots of crowds, make lots of money, and none of them think that it's going to be apocalyptic or the end of the world or that anything is going to happen. The Mayans never claimed that it would. That wasn't their thing. They had a Venus calendar, a lunar calendar, a solar calendar. They had a long count calendar running about 5,000 years, and one of those changes its pages from the 13th baktun to the 14th baktun, and it's just like us having the end of the year, and then we go to the first of the new year.
Right.
But because that wasn't enough to rile up the public, over 110 books, articles, TV specials on the History Channel, the Science Channel, people who should know better are invoking Nostradamus or invoking silly stuff to say that, well, it's not just the Mayans, but at the moment of the solstice, here's what's also going to happen. And this is where you get to totally fictitious stuff that has no astronomical basis at all. Several of the books were saying the sun is going to line up with the center of the galaxy, which it's not.
Okay.
And then it's going to channel energy from the other side of the galaxy. What kind of energy? What kind of energy gets channeled by the sun or by the stars? But the sun's not even going to be there to begin with. Recently, people said that there is a undiscovered planet.
Right.
It's called Nibiru. I may be mispronouncing it. And that scientists have known about it for years. The fact that our airport office party last week, and I hope he's listening, Glenn, was telling us that, governments have known, scientists know, astronomers know, and said, and you know, I'll be honest with you, Bob, you're probably in on the on the deliberate effort to keep it quiet.
Thought that for years.
That this planet is going to come in and it's going to ravage the solar system. Of course, astronomers say, if there's a planet and it's going to be here in 10 days, it would be pretty darn bright.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Right.
Plus, it would perturb the other planets. That's how we discovered Neptune and then Pluto, because planets shifted position by the presence of something unknown. None of the planets are moving at all. And there's other things, too. The sun is going to erupt. So you know what we're doing at SLU, the online observatory? We're going to use our big telescopes in the Canary Islands. We're not going to just poo-poo it and say, oh, this is all nonsense, even though we believe it is. But we're going to be looking. So we're going to spend all of next week, this is SLOOH, each night looking at the planets, looking along the ecliptic plane, seeing if there's anything there. We're going to have solar experts on. We're going to be monitoring the sun through solar telescopes to see what eruptions, what flares, prominences, coronal mass ejections, what's really happening. So if there really is something crazy happening, we'll be there, and we'll watch it, and we'll share it with people.
All right, fair enough. And if we're still here, you come back next month, and we'll talk about it. Merle in Argyle, thanks for waiting. Merle, you're on.
All right. This is sort of a theoretical question anyway. I just heard on the radio sometime this morning the Hubble telescope discovered two more galaxies that were 13.4 billion, light years away. can we extrapolate from that that the universe is at least 13.4 light years on the other side that we can't see?
Hmm.
No, that's a great question. And, you know, finding new galaxies on one hand is not exciting that much because there's 200 billion galaxies that are known. So finding three more as well. Okay, you found three more. But the exciting news, the reason this is news is because they're so far away. And the only way we can even see them is through gravitational lensing so that the bending of space focuses the light of these distant galaxies and makes things that would have been invisible visible. Now, as to the size of the universe, the real news is not just that the universe is double 13 billion light years in size, which it is, but that the visible universe, the visible universe extends for about 13 billion years because that's the radius in which light could reach us. We are now seeing more and more evidence that the universe is actually infinite. We talked about this last time.
Yeah.
And that the visible universe is like a ship in a bottle enclosed within an infinitely, and I'm using the word deliberately here, infinitely larger, an unknown larger universe. And that we're still trying to wrap our heads around that. That's new information just from this year. So this even transcends the slight pushing further away of the visible universe, just knowing that the actual universe is so much larger than we thought.
Okay, Merle, thanks a lot. So the edge of the bottle is just slightly further away than was the a couple of weeks ago. Joe and Troy. Joe, you're on.
How's it going?
Good.
My question is, what are your thoughts about the new type of fusion that the Navy is investing in, inertial electrostatic confinement, and dense plasma fusion, and how that relates or what that means for human space travel to Mars and beyond, and you know the edges of the galaxy.
Okay.
Well, this is outside my field. This research in this type of fusion. I mean, I know about stellar fusion, and nuclear fusion is a pretty simple process because you simply have hydrogen bonding together, four hydrogen atoms to make a single helium atom, and then you have a release of energy. In the sun's core, it's not very efficient. You only have a 0.07% efficiency, and yet that's enough so that the sun gives us all the nice light and heat that we've grown accustomed to getting. It as it converts 4 million tons of itself into energy per second. That's nuclear fusion. Now, of course, the quest is to create this here on Earth. You know about cold fusion. Everybody knows that harnessing fusion would be a much more efficient, safe, and clean way of doing things than nuclear fission, which is how our current electrical reactors go. I have not heard of success in fusion, and I'll have to look this up and see if they've, if someone actually has succeeded along those lines. This would be news to me.
All right.
One more question. The fellow who's working on this, they actually did a lecture for Google about dense plasma fusion. He referred to the process as basically catching a quasar in a bottle, and they do this by creating a plasmoid, high-energy plasmoid, and it folds in on itself, and for a moment it releases a massive amount of X-rays and heat and energy, and he said that this is something that happens in quasars. I guess my question is, could you just explain a little more about a quasar?
Okay.
Sure.
That's great.
Well, first of all, it's always going to be a plasma because a plasma is simply broken atoms. And what you'll get in most of the universe, the most common state of matter, are not whole atoms, but pieces. In other words, you have single electrons or single protons, single neutrons. That's a plasma, so no sense making it more complicated than it really is. A quasar is the core of galaxies in the early universe. We actually don't see any around us. There are no nearby quasars because back in the early days, we had almost supernova-like conditions occurring in the centers of galaxies back in the bad old days when it was more like the Wild West and galaxies were more massive. Now we have a black hole in the center of every galaxy so far as we know. But the quasars itself, the violence that used to take place in the cores of galaxies, perhaps all galaxies, is no longer happening. And that's why there are no full-fledged quasars within a billion light years of us.
Okay. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. So you mentioned that most of the universe has orphaned parts, electrons, yes, and neutrons. Now, my question for you is, were they at one time together as atoms, or is their natural state to be just by themselves, plasma, electrons?
Yeah, it's more common for that than to find each other. There's some mysteries involved in this, Ray. For example, cosmic rays, which are, material, again, plasma material that comes at us at very high speeds, mostly given off by supernova explosions and quasars, comes from other galaxies as well as violent parts of our own galaxies. For some reason, this almost all of it are protons. 90% of cosmic rays striking us. In other words, is this a nice random sample of what the universe is made of?
Yeah.
Striking Earth, penetrating our atmosphere, are protons. And a big question is, where are the electrons? There should be just as many electrons in the universe as protons. They should be equal. And yet we have almost no electrons hitting us. They're all protons.
See, that was my question. In other words, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Are there atoms first that get broken down and then the electrons become grouped as plasma? Or are all these parts just randomly floating around trying to come together?
That would be much more likely, just from Occam's razor. And because if you have matter forming from energy, it works both ways, E equals MC squared, works both ways, then if you have high energy matrices in the early universe, you'll get the formation of particles plus their antiparticle equivalent. And those will be particles.
Okay.
They still have to find each other to form whole atoms.
All right. Bob Berman is our guest. Our number to call is 800-348-2551. Our producer, Patrick Donges, is here with more from the social networking. Oh, he's got a microphone. Yeah. Hey, Zach, could we... Zach, the engineer, will turn your microphone on.
Hi, guys. Jeff on Twitter, Jeff M. McKinney, at Jeff M. McKinney, asks, can Bob suggest a good stargazing app? So I assume he means a phone.
Yeah, I like Starwalk. I think that's really good. And they've gotten actually less good in the last year because they've jazzed it up in a way that makes it less fun to use.
Do you know if that's iOS, Apple, or Android, or both?
I have it on my Apple. I know that.
Okay.
On my
that's right. That works there. There are some others that are, whose name I've forgotten, that are just as good. Starwalk was sort of the cream of the crop. And it's still.
I have another one on my. I have two on my phone. Maybe on the next break I'll go get it. There, I think Skyview or something like that.
And there's a few other nice programs for PCs too. And if I think of it, it's just a mental block at the moment. I'll let you know before the program's over.
All right, let's go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. Gregory in Kingston. Gregory, you're on.
Yeah. Hi. Yeah, I was just curious what your take is on, I'm not a scientist or a astronomer or anything, but I'm just kind of curious what your take would be on the Lady of Fatima incident of 1917. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
No.
No? In Mexico?
No. Tell me about it.
No, where was it? I'm not really certain where it was at.
Spain?
But it was,
I don't know. Yeah.
The children saw the mother of, the Mother Mary, whatever, up in the sky, and they told... They went back to the village and told them that that there was going to be a sign in the sky, and then everybody looked up, and this is supposedly fact.
Bob is shrugging, but I know a little bit about it, or at least a little of the history, that, the sun, according to all the people there, the sun came down from the sky. It was a rainy day, and the sun came down from the sky. It's very interesting. Of course, the Vatican investigated this, but scientists did as well, and... No one is really sure what happened, whether it was mass hysteria, whether it was some celestial or atmospheric event that went on, or whether it was truly a miracle. Great event to look into, but unfortunately...
Yeah, look into it. Maybe we can discuss it in the next show, because I think he'd find it really interesting.
Yeah, Gregory.
I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, I've never seen Bob shrug, so you really got him. You stumped the band.
Okay, great.
Good job, Gregory. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jim and Oneida or Oneonta? I can't tell.
Oneonta.
Oneonta, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
go back a few minutes to the question about the discrepancy in sunrise and sunset times on the solstices?
Sure.
I've always understood that to be resulting from the fact that the sun is not a point but a disk.
No, that's not why.
Well, sunrise is timed when the top of the sun emerges from the horizon, and the sun is about 5 minutes wide. And sunset is timed when the bottom of the sun disk disappears below the horizon.
No.
It gives a 10-minute discrepancy.
No. The sun is only 30 arcs. It's half a degree, 30 arc minutes wide, only half a degree wide.
So you put the two of them together, and it's a full degree wide.
That's right. And the sun moves its own through the sky, its own length in 2 minutes. And even at the slanting path that it takes at sunrise and sunset, it's 3 minutes. So the two together is 6 minutes. That does not explain why you should have an offset of 2 weeks either way. The offset is...
Not 2 weeks. It's only minutes between the sunrise and sunset at solstice.
So you're not talking about the earlier question where the person was asking about the time of sunset and sunrise being you are?
But I'm saying, on the day of solstice, the sunrise time and the sunset time, his question was, why don't they match up?
Okay, the answer is, the reason I was trying to avoid this before is because with a chalkboard, I can make this clearer. He mentioned the word analemma, and the analemma is really the key here. Because what you're comparing it is our clocks and at the time of sunrise and sunset. Since you're a knowledgeable listener, do you know what the analemma is?
Yes.
Okay. So picture taking a photograph or considering the sun's position at the same clock time each day, and you'd get that familiar figure eight. Now, that figure
it's
eight...
It's a stretched figure eight.
Yes, with a smaller one, both of the lobes are not the same.
Right.
Now, as the figure eight rises and sets and moves across the sky, that is where the sun's position would be, the time of your earliest sun rise is going to be where the sun is located on that analemma when it hits the eastern horizon or the southeastern horizon at the earliest sunset. The time of sunset... And you can draw this on a piece of paper so it's clear, is not going to be where the sun is on that part of the analemma, but where the sun is so that it's meeting the western horizon in that where that figure eight last meets the western horizon is the time that you're going to get the latest sunset, and vice versa, where it meets the earliest.
And that's where you came up with the December 7th and the January 6th.
Exactly. So those two positions of the sun are located almost a month apart.
Right.
And that's what determines your earliest sunrise and your latest sunrise and your earliest sunset and your latest sunset.
And the Christian Christmas season follows that exactly. It's a month between December 7th, which is St. Nicholas's Day, Santa Claus Day, and January 6th, the Epiphany.
I didn't even know that. That's
Jim,
great.
It's a great point. Yeah, we got to take a break here, but thank you very much for an interesting call.
It's very interesting.
All right, let's take a short one, and then we'll be back with Bob Berman, 800-348-2551.
Support comes from Lori Stilwell, CPA PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StilwellCPA.com. Rhinebeck Artists Shops in Rhinebeck and New Paltz, featuring holiday gifts, stocking stuffers, picture framing, and fine art materials for students, professionals, and the public for over 30 years. RhinebeckArt.com. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, presenting Cherish the Ladies, A Celtic Christmas. This Celtic ensemble shares Irish traditions and Christmas carols. This Saturday at 7:30, TroyMusicHall.org. And Jake Moon, Clarksville, New York, Country Eatery at the foot of the Helderbergs, featuring locally sourced food, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, weekend brunch with bluegrass music. JakeMoon.net.
Bob Berman is our guest, astronomer extraordinaire. The phone number to call is 1-800-348-2551. We go to Chuck in Mechanicville. Chuck.
Hey, gentlemen. How you doing?
Hello.
I have a question here about the Hubble, and that we've all seen the beautiful pictures it sends back. But I've also heard that when they're sent back, they're in black and white.
Yes, they are.
Why?
And they're colorized here.
That's correct. Absolutely correct.
Is there no color in the universe?
It's because...
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Is there?
The Hubble telescope is only equipped to take essentially pixels that make up the picture in grayscale. That's all it can do. So the pictures are all coming back in black and white. Now, to create a color picture, in practice, three separate images are taken, and depending upon what the requirement is for that image, if you want something that's going to resemble what the eye will see, then you'll do the red, green, blue filters, and then you'll reassemble it according to what the eye would see using any photo program. If you're looking for scientific information, and this is the usual thing, you'll take a picture in the wavelength that corresponds to glowing oxygen. At, for example, at 5,007 angstroms, you'll take a picture in the light that hydrogen gives off when it glows, which is at 6,563 angstroms. Maybe you'll take a third picture in glowing sodium or sulfur, whatever you're interested in. And right. Then assign them colors, which is often false colors, because after all, these things, you know, you don't have to make them look the way the eye would see. And then the result is often very beautiful, but doesn't resemble what the eye would see.
Chuck,
but
that's
how the color is produced.
That is a great question. It has been on my mind forever, and I thank you for bringing that up. You know, in your book that you did last Christmas time, which was The Strangest Things in the Universe, you had one of your top ones was this beautiful gas picture of gas emanating from the middle of a galaxy.
Oh, yes.
And was it blue?
Well, that one, if we're thinking of the same one, do you mean the gamma ray hourglass that
yes.
emanates from the center of our
yes.
galaxy? That was presented in blue, but gamma rays have no color, so we could colorize it any way we want just to present it, to see it.
But how accurate? In other words, maybe not gamma rays, but when we see pictures from the Hubble or anywhere else, are we seeing anything that resembles closely what we would see in visible light? I mean, I want to know what the universe... If I was in a spaceship and I was flying and I said, oh, look at that, are there beautiful colors to be seen out there?
Nobody would actually see colors in galaxies just because the light's so faint that it wouldn't trigger the cone-shaped color receptors in our eyes. In other words, the photopic vision that we have requires at least 0.7 Lamberts of brightness.
Yeah.
And we don't actually see that. So if we went up close to any of the galaxies that look so beautiful in the photographs, they'd look gray to the human eye.
Okay. And red giants are really red, though, right?
Yeah, they're orange. Actually, okay. A deep orange, like Betelgeuse, for
okay.
example.
All right. Well, Chuck, thanks for that. And I've often wondered the same thing. Martha in Albany. Martha.
Hi. Thanks for this program. It's very interesting.
Thank you.
My question is, for someone that, like myself who lives in the city of Albany, do you have any recommendation as to where you might go in a car that has accessible open sky and somewhat diminished light pollution to see?
I have a feeling that somebody like Ray, who actually lives here, could answer that better than I would, who lives an hour and a half.
Yeah, I mean, things have changed. I remember going to up in Voorheesville on the side of a hill, and I forget what road it was on, to see Hale Bopp. Back when I was a kid, we went to Thatcher Park, but I don't think you can go there at night anymore. I think you have to get out of the city.
Right, but what direction would provide an obstructed view? I know north from here, if you went but
yeah.
didn't quite go to Saratoga, there's a lot of farm country that you see from the air,
yeah.
and I would think that there'd be a lot of flat roads and a lot of places you could pull off, but I'll bet there's a lot of people out there listening to this who know exactly a great place to drive
yes.
to from Albany in half an hour or even less, because Albany's not that big a city. You could get to nice dark skies soon. Maybe
15 minutes, you'd be out of town.
You know, maybe some caller will tell us
okay.
the best place.
Martha, good luck. Are you going to look for the meteors tonight?
You bet. Thanks so much.
Me too. Let's go to Jeff in Schenectady. Jeff.
Hey, Professor. Thanks for being with us today.
Pleasure.
I wanted to talk about the size of the universe, but the intervening comment about the missing electrons has got me a little confused.
Uh-huh.
So this is not the one in 30 million imbalance between matter and antimatter is where these electrons are, right?
No, you're right.
And they're not hiding in black holes. We literally have no idea where they are.
That's right. That's right. And it's a deep mystery, isn't it? Why are cosmic rays protons? Why are they 90% protons?
And when we say interstellar hydrogen, do we mean protons or do we mean hydrogen atoms?
Well, if you're talking about neutral hydrogen atoms, then you're talking about neutral hydrogen atoms. For example, the 21
between the stars.
So that's one and one.
Well, the glow that really defines the plane of the galaxy and the spiral arms of the galaxy. Early on, we detected it because it gives off a glow in 21 centimeters wavelength,
right.
And that is the hydrogen. That essentially is just the glow that you'd get from neutral hydrogen, entire atoms of it. But the you're quite right. The core of every hydrogen atom is just a single proton. That's by far the most overwhelming and abundant object in the universe. It's surrounded by an electron. Why are only protons hitting us as cosmic rays? Or why are 90% of them protons? And where are the electrons? And why aren't they coming in?
Hmm.
Definitely going to research that one on my own. Let me, not to be a hog, just to go back to the size of the universe and give you a chance to clarify. So you were talking about the visible universe, which is 13 and change billion on each side, which, of course, is different from the observable universe, which is 40 billion on each side, plus or minus, right, because the space is expanded over the intervening 13 billion years. And then that, of course, is different from the infinite size of the actual universe. But most of that we don't call observable, because we could never observe it no matter how much time goes by, because it's expanding faster than we could ever see it.
That's right. And if you haven't made everybody's head spin enough, it even gets more than that, because when the light left the galaxies that we saw, the galaxies were closer to us. So when we observe a galaxy such as the one the earlier caller talked about, that's now some 13 billion light years away, so it is said, in truth, we were 1 billion light years or less from it when its light left us. And therefore, when we observe it, it should look much larger, because its size doesn't change just because the light spent a lot of time traveling through space. We should be theoretically looking at a giant galaxy, but because the light on its way to us has been stretched out by the ever expanding universe, and that's dimmed it, we should be seeing a galaxy that looks dimmer than something even 13 billion light years away. We should see a far dimmer galaxy and a far larger galaxy than what that 13 billion light years would suggest. And that's exactly what we find. We see that these distant things are huge, are weirdly huge and weirdly dim for their distance. And then there's a third thing, because they've been moving all this time while their light has been en route to us. Where are they today? And today, that galaxy isn't 13 billion light years away. It's 38 billion light years away.
Right. So when in the media they say we've seen the most distant galaxy at 13.4 billion, they're talking about a galaxy that was a billion years away when it emitted the light is 38 billion years, or billion light years away today. So really what they're referring to is the age of the light. Is that...
They're referring to how long the light has been traveling to us.
Right,
it was actually, you just slightly misspoke there. The galaxy was actually only 1 billion light years away when it emitted the light from us.
It's hard not to misspeak in these cases.
All right.
Thanks for the opportunity to clarify.
I need a drink. Let's go to the next caller, Alice in Walden. Alice, you're on.
Great. Hi. This has been a wonderful show. My question is, I'm a native Fairbanks girl, born and raised, I want to know if you think there's a crackle from the Northern Lights.
Oh, that's such a great question. And you're from Fairbanks. That's so wonderful.
Yes, I am. I'm born and raised, and I go there often. I was just there in October.
Oh, that's so great. Because, of course,
so
we'll be
spoiled.
There. I'll be bringing a group of 40 people there in early March. Mm. And we'll be going,
that's what you said.
And you
now,
know,
where are you?
If,
where
you're,
are you?
If you're from Fairbanks, then you know Chena Hot Springs.
I certainly do.
And so that's our ultimate destination. But we'll spend a few days in Fairbanks. To answer your question, I've spoken to people at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks.
Yep.
One fellow, Professor Brown in particular, who's very knowledgeable about the Northern Lights, and several others who have studied it. I've interviewed a lot of people who have heard crackles, hisses, noises from the Northern Lights. But these researchers all insist that they've put sensitive microphones under the most riotous displays and never detected any sounds whatsoever. And yet so many people, including a fellow named Ned.
I'm sure I did.
And I believe the people who say they did. We have a fellow in Woodstock, Ned House, who owns the big hardware store there, who insists that when he's gone hunting the far north, he's heard these sounds. And I think people can detect, if not actual audio sounds, then perhaps the electromagnetic phenomena that radiate from them high above.
Wow.
There's no reason why you should actually be hearing an aurora. It's too high up and the air is too thin. But
yeah.
I think some people may have the ability to somehow make those sounds, the electromagnetic disturbance that accompanies them, somehow they
disturbs
are perceiving them as an auditory experience. It would be mysterious. I can't explain how, but I believe the people who say they, including you, who say they've heard it.
Thank
you. Alice, thanks a lot. You know, is it akin to the early astronauts who said, well, we've seen these bright spots in our eyes?
And, maybe.
You know, and you and I have talked about this before, but I know, and I'm not the only one who was there, big bolide, we heard it.
Oh, interesting.
And maybe it's the same phenomenon.
That's right. It
here.
Would be the same phenomenon because a bolide is 80 miles up, not too distant from an aurora. And also, you should not be able to hear a bright meteor, but you did.
We definitely did.
And I
not
believe
just
you.
Me. Okay.
I believe you.
Barry in Kingston. Barry.
Hi. Yeah, I'm wondering, the space shuttle is, the Hubble telescope is due to be dropped out of space. Can we find somebody use for it? I have a contest among Montpelier universities who can find the best use for the shuttle, for the space telescope Hubble before it falls out of space.
Well, you'd have to sure, if you could find a way to get that nice 94-inch mirror down to Earth. We'd all love to have that best ever mirror, although remember it was misshapen. It did have spherical aberration.
I didn't say the mirror, just the unit itself would hold all the electronics, the power supplies and everything.
Well, I'm sure the people who run it in Baltimore would be happy to say, hey, look, when we're finished with it, if you can get it, go ahead, get
yeah.
it.
Barry, thanks a lot. Appreciate the call. Now, was that not a situation where when they made this, somebody had inches and centimeters incorrect?
That explained why you had that unfortunately Mars Observer probe about 10 years ago failed. Because the manufacturer designed it to be used in English units and to be propelled in English units, and the NASA controlled it using metric. No, the Hubble failed because the testers that were used, this was Perkin Elmer of Danbury,
mm-hmm.
that had the contract for it, and they tested its shape. They polished it just beautifully, but they polished it to the wrong shape because their fancy tester called a reflective null corrector told them it was right, but the tester was misaligned by the thickness of a dime. And their older tester, their refractive null corrective, told them that it was wrong, that it had spherical aberration. And what they criminally did with this discrepancy, instead of saying, well, let's retest it again, they just said, the old one must be wrong. The old tester must be wrong. So they delivered to NASA a mirror that was cut perfectly, but to the wrong shape. So it had no errors along the curve, but the curve was wrong.
So they corrected this with a computer algorithm of some kind?
Remember, there was something called COSTAR, which Story Musgrove and his fellow astronauts brought up, and it was the equivalent of a contact lens.
Ah.
So that as the light came to a focus, it was corrected.
Brilliant.
Before the instruments got it.
Let's go to Jim in North Pownell. Jim, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey.
Listen, that woman that was looking for a really good place to view a meteor shower.
Yeah.
Within a reasonable drive from Albany.
Yeah.
If she goes east on Route 2 through Troy and then goes to the top of the Petersburg Pass on Route 2.
Oh.
You got a 360-degree view. There is zero light pollution. It is absolutely fantastic. You can see the top of Mount Greylock. You can see all the way up to the high peaks of the Adirondacks. And the sky view is absolutely fantastic.
Hey, great. You came through for us.
Yeah,
thank
I appreciate
you.
That very much. I just hope that the property owners don't get upset if everyone goes there. I mean, you know, consult your local listings, obviously. Lucy in East Greenbush. Lucy, you're on.
Hi. Your previous caller just beat me to it, but I was going to suggest that there's a place in Pennsylvania that is reportedly the darkest skies on the eastern seaboard. It's a state park called Cherry Springs, and they have an astronomy field where you can go with your RV or your tent and set up overnight with power at every campsite.
You know, that sounds great, but I think the people here are talking about grabbing the kids from Albany, and where can you go in half an hour or 45 minutes?
I understand. I understand. This is 5 hours away, but it is a wonderful facility. I just thought I'd mention it.
Thank you. Like it. Lucy, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go over to John and Troy. John.
Hi, gentlemen, and I apologize if you guys have already spoken to this. I kind of jumped on late in this program. It's one of my favorites. I heard earlier this morning that NASA plans on launching a new space telescope called the James Webb in about 5 years.
Yes.
And I had not heard about this, and I was curious if you guys could speak to the differences and capabilities between the James Webb and the Hubble, like what sort of.
Okay. Well, it's a much larger telescope. It used to be called the Next Generation Space Telescope, and then it was renamed James Webb. And it's, of course, over budget and behind in when it's supposed to be launched. Some of us are a little worried about it, frankly, because unlike the Hubble, which is, as you know, in fairly low Earth orbit, some 250 miles up where it can be serviced if needed, this next telescope, the James Webb, is going to go on the far side of the moon, something like a quarter of a million miles outward. Don't quote me on that figure, but I'm just saying way beyond what astronauts could ever reach in service. And so if anything ever goes wrong with it, it can't be fixed up.
Well, it'll take a few days to get there.
Right.
It'll be
and it's going to be mostly an infrared telescope, whereas the Hubble was very good in the visual range. This is going to be maximized for the infrared.
All right, John, we're out of time, but thank you for the call. And thank you, Bob Berman. A wonderful job. And assuming the apocalypse doesn't hit, we'll have you
on
next
week. We
didn't
get any calls.
How about that? That's because people are rational today. Support comes from United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York. Live United, give, advocate, volunteer. UnitedWayGCR.org. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, Massachusetts, a New England craft program offering workshops for adults and teens taught by master craftspeople on a 50-acre farm. Snowfarm.org. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Albany, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. Add natural fiber, featuring cellulose insulation made locally in New England from recycled materials for over 30 years. NationalFiber.com. Thanks again for joining us today on Vox Pop. Thanks to Bob Berman, our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Christy Carton for answering the phones. Our producer, Patrick Donges. I'm Ray Graff. Moyers & Company tomorrow. Next week, it's Medical Monday. Stay tuned now for a news update.